Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hey, everybody. This is Aiden, and welcome back to Tracking Connections.
Hey, everyone. Sarah here. We are with Jenny Griffiths and Paul Aston, co-founders of the Manzanita School and Institute.
Yep. These good people here that I love very dearly, I've known for a while, and just really lift up the work that they do there in Topanga Canyon. Everywhere I go around the world, I always brag about you too and what you're doing. And the role models that you are, you know, the role model that your school and institute has become. And yeah, just so many accolades I hear from people as I travel. So we wanted to lift you guys up for sure, because you've been at this for a while. And I'll just say that Paul and Jenny can speak for themselves, that's for sure. But I wanted to mention that Paul took over as a principal at a school down, it was called the Mariposa School, right? It's at Thousand Oaks, California. And for the prior year or two, I had been asked to come down and do a teacher training by the then principal. And when Paul took over, he wanted to continue that. And that's how we met. So I'd done a kind of a day-long retreat around Coyote's Guide, essentially, right? We were working with these teachers who are working with younger children, yeah, like primary school children, and lovely bunch. And then Paul came to took me to breakfast before I had to head back home. And he told me about this vision he had for what he could do with a school. And I think I'm being tame. Paul will correct me here as soon as I'm done. I said to Paul, I hope you really don't believe that even if you did pull that off here, that it would last very long, because public schools are notorious for disrupting innovative things like that, especially when they start to become successful. It's amazing to me. I've seen it so many times. So I was kind of warning you, Paul, you know, I don't know. I think you ought to start your own private school, but go ahead. Tell everybody how mean I really was.
Thanks, John, Sarah, and Aiden. My memory of the story was, yeah, I couldn't stop talking to people about my thoughts about education. Jenny and I have been in this dialogue, had been in the dialogue already for a couple of decades, both teachers, and having a lot of really robust morning conversations around Greek coffee, getting up early with the birds and just visioning what we thought would be really in the best service and interest of kids and families. So I had had these ideas formulating for quite a while. I'd already finished my doctoral research, and now I had become this principal of a very progressive alternative K-8 public school. Yeah. And I shared those ideas with you, and you didn't pull any punches with me, John. We were walking back, and you said, my recollection was, you said, and it shocked me because it felt like, wow, he just undermined everything I said. But on another level, it felt like a real subtle, it maybe not subtle, nudge. But you said to me, so Paul, what are you going to do when all these ideas fail here? And I was like, what do you mean? And you're like, well, I mean, what are you going to do when all these visions that you have just don't work in this setting? And I was like, it was my first year as a principal. I was like, well, what am I supposed to do with that question? And, you know, we bantered back and forth about it. And it was interesting because at that point, there was no idea to open an alternative, something different than Mariposa, which was this public school where I had a great commitment to public education, and I could never see myself in a private setting. Lo and behold, though, the opportunity arose and the freedoms were there, resources were there. And I made that decision to go forward. And I did really enjoy getting to come up to Santa Cruz and hang out with you and talk a little more about it after some of the things had fallen into place to make that happen. So yeah, but that initial moment was, and it was in between you talking about a group of birds that were like ditching into a bush and your robust laughter. And it was like this really gregarious, wonderful time. But you really said to me flat out, like, what are you going to do when your idea fails? I was like, yeah, I didn't get, like, you were being a bit prescient and also a little subtle coyote mentoring maybe in there too.
I'm not sure what I was doing other than just imagining what I had seen in so many other public schools around the country where people actually really tried to do similar things, got some traction, and then all of a sudden some parents totally revolted, you know, there's not enough of this and it's too much of that. And what is this hippie stuff or whatever, you know, and then the principal gets moved to another district and, you know, like all this kind of reshuffling happens and the whole thing just goes up in smoke. And that's what I was terrified of for you, Paul. was that you obviously had developed this, you and Jenny talking about it, it had become very real. Like you guys could see it, right? You could feel it in the ethers. And I just thought it was so precious, and I did not want to see you fail. I just did not. I was like, please, please go private. Then you got it.
And so I'm so curious, what did that spur in you, that disruption?
Well, I honestly thought John just didn't know what was going on. Like I figured he wasn't really clued into how hip this school was and how creative I was going to be about it. And, you know, I don't know that I told you this part of the story, but I know I was asked by the assistant superintendent of instruction to build this whole visionary curriculum that I had. And I did. And it was like 14 pages long. And I began meeting with my middle school team. And nobody was interested in that. They all were like, we're doing it this way. So thanks for your ideas. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. I'm the principal and these middle school teachers are thanking me for creative ideas and then telling me, but you know, I was in Thailand for 12 years and I'm teaching meditation and that's what I do. And they all had their own ideas. And it was the third school that I had tried to do this in. And now that I was principal and it was an alternative school, I figured this is going to be the place. But no, it ended up not being. It was the fourth time was the charmer.
Well, I'm glad you kept going.
And so, Jenny, where were you in this and how did you both birth the school together?
That's a big story of all being invited into this onto this property by two people that were running the school. And then they later dropped out, which was a blessing. And it's been this beautiful dialogue. And I've come from a background, I'm an art teacher and also homeschooled my girls for big chunks of time. So this idea of how do children learn and the sort of breaking that convention was really an opening experience for me with our daughters and seeing what was possible outside of what we have decided is school and decided is learning. Remember somebody telling me early on, you can't keep a child from learning. You know, I mean, you have to work at it, you know, which a lot of schools do. They, you know, kill that love of learning. And so, yeah, it's just this place of heart for our own daughters, and then this invitation to the property and Paul's, you know, holding such beautiful vision as well. And it just felt like an incredible opportunity and gift. I mean, I don't know what else. It was just kind of a little bit of magic.
I feel that beautiful inspiration. Can you tell us more about what Manzanita School is?
Absolutely. And it's worth pointing to the backstory a little bit. I had been teaching at the local elementary here prior to Mariposa, prior to the school that I was principal at. I was a sixth grade teacher here at the local elementary. I actually started as a fifth grade teacher. And then the principal and I managed to get sixth grade added. It's a charter school, so it's got some freedom. And we had a plan to add seventh and eighth grade. And that's kind of where the first obstacle came, my intention was to support middle schoolers, that transitional moment from child to adult that's tended so consistently and so well by nature-based peoples, that's very ancestral to all of us, that connects very deeply to all the intuitions that informed my teaching for a long time. I come from an anthropology background. I had studied prehistory as an undergraduate. That's my bachelor's degree is prehistoric studies. And then I had done master's and doctorate that also wove anthropology. So I have this orientation to, well, you know, humans haven't lived like this for very long, and really wanting to dig into my own sense of what are kids asking for when they're 12, 13, 14. So at this sixth grade middle school program that I was running at a K-6 school, I would watch them leave after sixth grade, after a year of deep connective, relational community building, a lot of time in nature right next to the state park, and then watching them go off, you know, full of energy and life force, and then seeing them step into my room in the afternoons, getting off that middle school bus to come visit me, and seeing the light gone from their eyes and their voices and their bodies. And it was heartbreaking. I get emotional talking about it. I saw this decimation of the spirit of human beings at the middle school that I actually went to. So I wasn't surprised because I was there, 2,400 students, 36-minute periods, very little adult supervision, youth-mediated culture, Lord of the Flies. And what I learned in my doctoral program was that middle schools are developmentally antithetical to everything we know about human development. And that's not enough information to change the paradigm. So in that experience of watching these kids come back in to my room is when I really started trying to source understanding. And I was in the middle of this doctoral program in this research and Jenny and I are in these dialogues every morning. And I'm really looking for like, what's missing? What is going on here? And I kind of zeroed in on risk behavior because that's the thing that's most ubiquitous in youth. And I began to understand that they were doing dangerous and what we might call poorly considered things that were often harmful to them, from whether it's racing cars to downing bottles of hard liquor to running from the police to tagging buildings to doing things that could kill them often. And it was rarely, all the research was saying, it's not about them doing this because they are wanting to hurt themselves. They're trying to activate a narrative of themselves as an agent of heroism and fearlessness. And they're trying to basically enact a rite of passage in the absence of adults. And the rite of passage has these elements that are universal, and they're trying to do that. So I was like aware of that. And I'm like, well, what do the adults need to be bringing to them? Which kind of brings us to the present moment, which is one of the things youth are asking for unconsciously, in addition to robust challenges. And nature has so many opportunities to give them that so that they don't feel like they have to find their heroism or their courage or their stories in unsafe and unsupervised ways. They wait and listen for us to take them into wild spaces and give them opportunities. Our seniors all do solo overnights. They all go on expeditions. There's a lot of opportunities for this beautiful third teacher of the more than human world of nature to provide all of that for them. And the other thing, though, that I'm beginning to really deeply understand, which is sort of the second version of Manzanita after we've been in operation for 10 years, is, and I've known this for a long time, and we're really ready to begin working this more deeply into their experience, but they're also waiting for a story. So when you get to be at the transitional age of becoming an adult, and it's different for different people, but you can kind of imagine it from age 9, 10, when they leave magical thinking, into 15, 16, when they're fully in their adult bodies. There's this whole world of transition that's physical, emotional, psychological. And what they're waiting for, I really believe this deeply, and the evidence is there for it, is the kind of waiting for a holistic cosmological story that makes sense, ties it all together. Where have I come from? Who am I? Where am I going? And they're waiting for us to tell it to them. And the beautiful thing is, we're at this moment in our human story where to talk about the origin of the universe, to talk about the mystery of and nuance of the intelligence of the natural world, to talk about a living planet, you know, Earth system science, the planet is a biophysiology, it's alive. Like to be able to bring this to them in science and to talk about what we call the great turning, that's coining Joanna Macy and David Corton and others, that we're in a moment where it's like the human being is awakening in some really important ways, remembering who they are and where they've come from. And it couldn't happen a moment sooner. You know, I think we're all just pulling out of a heat wave. The hottest day on Earth was a couple of days ago. So we're in this time when the Earth is like activating this awakening. I think we're sort of part of the immune system of the Earth. So then what do the kids need to hear? Do they need to hear the battles of the Civil War, the names of the Egyptian pharaohs, the capitals of the states? Or do they need to hear that they're magical beings threaded to a living Earth? And like, that's what they need to hear every day from us adults. And we need to give them the evidence for that. And when they start to hear that, my experience, because that's what I did in my self-contained classroom. And I'm learning now that that's what I did. I was intuitive at the time, but in reflecting on the big picture, I see, yeah, they're just waiting for us to tell them that they're these incredibly unique and magical and mysterious and wondrous humans on an amazingly brilliant, beautiful living planet. And we got some work to do, y'all. Let's do that. And when they're getting that story every day and they're getting it reinforced through academics, through silent receptivity in nature, through the core routines, thank you, John and H. Shields and all your community of people that's built such beautiful curricula content for us like that. When they get this stuff on a regular basis, this thing happens that the anthropologists call communitas, where they start to feel a utopian sense of efficacy. And it's not rose-colored glasses. It's like fierce and unyielding and full of thrill, joy, wonder, curiosity. And I kind of feel like Jenny said, you know, you have to work hard to deny a young person their passion for learning. And schools have exquisitely managed to figure that little thing out. Like, how do you drain life force? I don't know why we do it. I don't know why we continue to follow that pattern. So we're at this point now where we're integrating a bigger story into the experience of particularly middle schoolers. And we've been at this for, like I said, 10 years, and we're seeing emergence. David Abram, a dear friend of both John's and mine, has sort of had this way of describing livingness as not just isolated to, you know, the organisms that we're familiar with, but that ideas are alive and systems are alive. And I see Manzanita as alive. This school is like living, and I'm trying to watch, what is it asking for? Like, where is it needing nourishment? Where is it emerging? And how are we all participating in that? And it's kind of a cool idea, and it feels very real. So, yeah, that's kind of hopefully where you were going with your question, but I wanted to share that little bit of a framing.
Wow. Yeah, I'm so incredibly inspired. And your passion is just so powerful. And I also have this really interesting sense of grief coming up around not having had those things that you're naming, but just really overwhelming gratitude that you are providing this for so many people, young people. And there's so many people in this movement that are interested in education or pursuing, you know, schools, building schools and designing schools around this. What would you say to them?
Well, what would you say? You can't give what you don't have. So it's really important to be in your own journey with all of this. You don't have to be there, but just a commitment to the beauty, the journey, the excitement. Yeah. So that's where I would start, is just to, and it's really easy to get bogged down in all of the machinery of it. So we're constantly dancing between the heart and the machine, and the machine charges tuition, but it's like, you know, it's hard. It's hard to manage all of that and then still have this deep commitment to community, to all the beings that we get to be in these oak trees every day, like just this exquisite space and land and hearts and, you know, this energy of these beautiful young people as they're growing into who they're meant to be. And that's just a profound honor. And it can be easy to forget that when you're like, you know, we got to get you there to the, you know, recess is now and, you know, calm down or, you know, whatever, all those things of management. Mm. So anyway, I don't know. It's and then just be in partnership, be in community around it. Don't try to do it all yourself, because it's an emergent with everybody that's there too, right? So listen to your space, to the land, to your elders, to your neighbors, and reach out.
Yeah, and I would add that to individual teachers, you know, pay attention to your deep sense of your role. And the best teachers I've ever met in any school prioritize community and connection with their kids first. And some of them do it beautifully, and they have these tremendously vibrant classrooms. And other teachers feel a lot of fear and anxiety around the content needs to be, the core standards need to be, and I need to assess. And so that model is no longer the model. The model is community. And a lot of teachers are learning how to do that, or have been able to do that well out of their own deep skill. And so the world is full of amazing classrooms. So sort of the seeds are already there. It's like a little bit like mycelia, you know, it's like everywhere already. And every once in a while, the mushroom pops up and you go, oh, what's that? And it's already there. So it's also acknowledging the research right now. Another person that John and I both talk about frequently is Richard Louvre, who has done a beautiful job of committing to how do I assemble information for people curious about the impacts and role of nature, nature immersion, nature therapies in human development and psychological pathology and all this. And one of the areas that I've sort of gone the rabbit hole I'm in now is risk behavior, which is ubiquitous, especially among little kids. Like, why do kids take all these risks? Why do they climb trees? Why do they play fight and really do stuff that they always get? Basically, the research says they're trying to get bruises and scratches. That's kind of the model of their body, that I'm doing it right. And there's a lot of fear in schools. I was a principal and teacher and yard supervisor in 7 different schools where citation if you misuse equipment, citation if you're running in the wrong place, citation if you play fight, citation if you raise your voice, you know, sit on the bench. And it was management for us. It was fear of litigation. Man, our kids in the forest kindergarten play with sticks. You know, when I was in schools and growing up, I was like, put your eye out. They're really careful to play in a way that's just at the edge all the time, all the time. And they practice authoritarianism. They practice domination. They practice egalitarianism. They try every model. And the research says, and this is what I was going to say, and thank you, Richard Louvre and others, and the invitation is to teachers, pay attention to what we know. Because what we know is they should not be sitting in desks all day, if at all, until seven. I don't know. However, what we do know is that human development demands that we pay attention to intuitively what they're doing with their bodies. And they are making up stories. They're playing. They're building families. They're creating empires. They're doing this to create and establish the competencies that will make them efficient, productive, healthy human beings in culture, society later on. And when we deny them that, and this is what's so provocative in the literature, is they develop phobias and psychopathologies and neuroses in the absence of risky play and self-directed play in wild spaces. And so I say to teachers, like, you know, and principals and school districts, is take a breath, take a moment, and pay attention to what we know, because that landscape is changing as fast as anything. You know, I am continually amazed at where intelligence is emerging within the research on natural systems, like what pheromones are telling the other ants in the ant colony. You know, like if a group of foragers in the ant colony, there's like maybe eight different roles. And if a group of foragers gets devoured by an anteater, their pheromonal signatures are no longer in the mix, and all the other ants analyze that together collectively, and then they redistribute the roles through communication through these molecular pheromones, which are like little hieroglyphs that land on the receptors and tell them big stories about what's happening. That's a kind of intelligence that, man, you cannot write that off to, oh, that's just instinct, that nature made that. Because novel things that never existed, one of the examples that, oh, who did the biophilia stuff? Edward O. Wilson, yeah. He basically Wilson, says, yeah. You know, if you see a boot that crushed an ant colony, they're encountering something that they didn't normally encounter, and they know how to rebuild from novel experiences. Like, those are the sorts of things that challenge the instinct explanation, and you really have to wonder if their intelligence is fluid, which makes it a lot more like what we're familiar with in our hubris as humans. So, yeah, inviting teachers, lean into community, lean into your intuition about what kids really need from you, because they need connection, validation, and being seen first. And they'll swallow and absorb and engage all the content after that happens. And then also, like, what does the research say is like good for kids? It's pretty clear now. They need to be outside. They need to stop memorizing stuff and getting homework. That stuff isn't helping them. And the amount of medication of kids between the ages of 15 and 25 should tell us that we are creating an epidemic of anxiety, depression, self-harm. And that stuff is directly related to their treatment up to that point. You know, John, one of the first and most powerful experiences I had coming to Art of Mentoring in Santa Cruz was encountering 22-year-olds that were running everything, who were grounded, awake, healthy, articulate, full of joy, and not drug abusing, and not flaky. I mean, at first glance, feral humans look a little like New Age hippies, but they're very different species.
Oh, thank you for that, Paul.
What does this look like in terms of getting the parents involved? And what does it look like when it's working?
That's a great question. And we do a lot of things to try to pull our parents in. We have parent hawk days where they go out with the naturalist. They're invited to go out and have the same experience as their kids. We do parent council, which is one of the cornerstones of what we do, which is sitting in circle telling stories. And that's another thing that their kids do basically every day, but definitely a long chunk every week. And we have them for lunch, you know, they come have lunch with the kids and come, and then we have festivals, and then we do all of these things. But the best teachers are their own kids. So that's what we hear a lot is, we went on a hike and my kid knew all the names of all the plants and all the animals. And they're like blown away that their child gets to teach them these beautiful things. So we just do our best. We just try all sorts of ways, and noticing a little more yearning for parents to be, a lot of times the parents say, oh, I wish I could go to Manzanita. You know, I wish this was there for me when I was a kid. And there is some grief that parents experience around that. So tending that. And it's also sometimes interesting that some parents come in and they're, and that yearning is they want Manzanita to be everything. And sometimes we disappoint them. And that's true too. So that's, yeah.
Yeah. And it's probably important to say a little structurally, Aiden, what the school's doing. So we have a system of what we call owl days and hawk days. And the owl days, if you showed up on an owl day, you probably recognize math and language arts and classrooms and desks. And if you came on a hawk day, you'd probably wonder why those kids are all muddy. What are those kids doing over there? Where is everyone? Because we're next to several thousand acres of resource conservation land, and we may be just out there. And, you know, what are these sit spots? Why do they have blindfolds on? What are they doing? Why is that kid hiding in the bushes? So those are hawk days. And those are when a typical week, it's 60% owl days. So they're in the classroom doing more traditional academics. We're an accredited school with the Western Association of Schools and Colleges. We've graduated 7 classes of seniors, and they're all in college. A couple kids are taking a gap year. The ones that have graduated college, it's important to say 3.8 grade point averages at good universities. We just graduated 2 students from Berkeley. I mean, they're going to good schools and they're doing really well. And we're at the point now where one of them actually has come back and is a full-time naturalist at our school after graduating from Warren Wilson College on a full scholarship with a degree in environmental education. And they're not just studying environmental education. They're doing cognitive science. A woman just graduated with a biology degree because in my class, she started studying mycology, and now she's a mycologist. And she's studying all the nuanced stuff about it, which is far out. That's way beyond my pay grade, but it's fascinating to me. So I say all that to say that this model does not do what most schools do, which is say they got to be in the classroom. How can we carve out more academic time? Where do we get more room to give them more academics and more homework? Academics is very important. And what we do, though, is we take 2 days a week and we go out on the land, and we call these hawk days. And there's 2 very specific activities on each of the 2 days. One day it's called Canyon, and that's just the core routines of nature connection. And we've scoped and sequenced, you know, knife skills and bird language. And there's a lot of things we teach at specific times. And that's been built by Ira Christian, who actually came out of your world, John, and the training that you provided him and other folks like him. And then the other day that we take kids out is called stewardship. We have an active permaculture farm, and we also just have zones of the property. And this is cross grade level. So they go out, third graders all the way to high schoolers, in groups of 10 with a mentor all year in a zone of the property where they pay attention and they tend. And the idea of that is, you know, humans, if you believe Kat Anderson and other people that have studied nature-based peoples, we have always been mutually symbiotic. You know, symbiosis is the story of the day in the natural world. Our bodies are an amazing symbiosis of humans and non-human cells. So the symbiosis is kind of the story of the day. And Lynn Margulis wrote a beautiful book about symbiosis, the late Lynn Margulis. So the stewardship is really about activating mutual symbiosis and interrupting parasitic symbiosis. And it's learning how it feels to be a tender of the earth. So there is the Canyon Day, which is deep nature connection. And there's the Stewardship Day, which is really participating in the Great Turning and being an active agent of change to help the land. And these are the 2 days that we spend outside. And despite the fact that we have basically cut back the academic week by 40%, the outcomes for kids academically are more than compensated for by their levels of engagement. It's also an amazing antidote to ADHD, which is ubiquitous all over the place. It's interesting, you know, the way you medicate ADHD in young people is you stimulate them, because when you overstimulate them, the body responds by calming down. Too much stimulation, calm down. Stimulate the nervous system with an amphetamine and they calm down. Take them into wild spaces where there's a butterfly right now in the bougainvillea, where everything is moving and shadows are moving and light and wind and animals are making sounds. That's a huge amount of natural stimulation. And the human body in young kids calms down. I don't think it calms down because it's too much stimulation. It calms down so that awareness can come in its place. So they come into the classroom after being outdoors and they're focused and they don't have expressions of hyperactivity or attention deficit. So it's also one of the ingredients to a more academically efficacious program is to bring them into the natural world and let that regulate their nervous systems so that they can focus when they're in those desks. So the hawk days on the land connect to the academic program, which is another piece of what we do. So I would say, in terms of the format of our school, it's deep time in nature, very intentional. And then academics, which focus on an interdisciplinary theme on earth system science, on biotic regulation of the planet. How is the planet living? And that provides a cognitive balance for deep nature connection. And then we study the Great Turning as a humanities interdisciplinary course, showing how the humans are really changing the way they interact with one another and with the earth. Done a big study on the rights of nature movement. And that connects to stewardship because now they're out tending the land with their hands. And so when you build an embodied academics and a cognitive academics that are balanced, that sort of helps the big picture. So in terms of just, you know, another school wanting to replicate what we do, which we are building sort of manuals of replication that hopefully in the next 3 to 5 years we'll be able to support other schools with, we have to be willing to take the leap of faith that the intelligence of the natural world and of humans in relationship with the natural world, that intellectual, and I use that word cautiously, but that dynamic of human developmental ancestral, that model is incredibly important for us in this time. And that willing to take chances with the old model and taking it apart and reconceptualizing it, because so much school reform is about, it's kind of like reforming something that doesn't work. We have to be willing to break the spell of more academics means a better human, more prepared young person. It doesn't really add up.
You know, you guys are so inspiring. I've been brought to tears so many different ways today. Chills, goosebumps, you know, I am so, so thankful for what you two are doing and all the other dedicated people there, volunteers and helpers. And I heard you tell me a story once recently when you came up and visited Sarah and I here in Santa Cruz about what happened when you started to add younger and younger, younger children to Manzanita School. And that role that people keep swapping and going out and, you know, taking turns, I wouldn't even call it supervising because you don't really need to supervise them. You know, you just sort of have to keep them safe, right? You were noticing that you had never kind of had that role. Like, you know, you went from principal, you know, your teacher, and then all of a sudden you're just outside standing there with these little people that are wandering around and doing stuff. And then they're making discoveries and coming back and telling you things. You're just like, your mind is blown by their creativity, their sort of ethereal nature, the things that they're saying that are all just, you know, but you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I waited this long to do this. This is one of my favorite parts of Manzanita.
Yeah, I think Jenny, being the director of the K2 program, I want to let her weigh in on that a little bit, like how that's changed everything.
That has changed everything. I mean, it really has been, you know, we just see the whole arc now, which is so, it's like you feel like your family's complete, that kind of feeling. And I, and there is just a really good story that I want to tell if we have the time. I was down in the Kinder area. So they have this beautiful seasonal creek and this hillside, and the kids were playing in the hillside and they found a stink bug, and they immediately divided into two camps, the camp that wanted to kill the stink bug and the camp that wanted to make a little home for the stink bug. So I said, well, what's the stink bug's name? And this little boy, Otis, he said, oh, Miss Jenny, it'll be so hard to kill it if we give it a name. And it was just such this beautiful, you know, wisdom moment. So I'm not sure what they did with stink bug, but those kinds of things just keep happening where there's just this beautiful wisdom and just like, of course, you know, Grandfather Oak told me this thing. Like, I mean, it's like, duh, you know? And then they have these nature names where they so beautifully identified. So another story is just this girl, Serene, and she had her nature name was Quail. And they were in their outdoor classroom, and a covey of quail came by, and she was so excited. And later she wrote this story, and she said, I am quail. I am quail. And then she wrote, it was the best day of my life. It's like, it was just so, I just wanted, yeah, such beautiful, deep connection without any convincing, which sometimes with the, you know, some of our kids need a little extra support in that, but the youngers are just there.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Yeah, they're so deeply woven in to the story of the land and of the place and of the beings and of the magic. And they're relentless with it. And they're so dang knowledgeable too. Oh my. So these first graders are hanging out and they have lots of birds that come visit, and they name these birds that come visit. And there was Rennie Wren, which was a canyon wren. And Rennie Wren came in and they were like reading a story in the bamboo forest. And one of the kids went, look, it's Rennie Wren. And another kid looked up and said, that's not Rennie Wren. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of kids go, yeah, that's not Rennie Wren. And they, what was so moving for me when I heard this story was it's one thing to know one species from another. That's a scrub jay, you know. But they started to get so nuanced that they were having intra-species discernment. And I was so curious that I did an entire speaker series presentation on this question of, in a time when we all want to revise the systems really quickly, and there's a huge necessary movement trying to dismantle systems of institutionalized racism, as just one example of a very powerful movement. And an idea that many have, that each of these specific areas is it's its own most vital, critical thing to do. And Brian Swim told me recently, he's a mathematical cosmologist, and I was sharing with him this challenge of like everyone having a passion and wanting it to be central. And he said, but the change is omnicentric. So it's everywhere. So here I am, like the ism I'm trying to understand and dismantle is anthropocentrism, which most people can't even say it, but it's the idea that the human tells themselves, I'm above and beyond every other being. And it's, you know, it's scripture. Thou shalt have dominion over all that, you know, fly through the air and crawl upon the land. So when I saw this child like going, oh, that's not, I suddenly wondered, like, is the beginning of dismantling racism dismantling anthropocentrism, where, oh, that's just a bunch of birds, that's just a bunch of oak trees? No, actually, look at the individual beings within each of these groups that we name. So there's actually this huge body of research that came out of a team out of Switzerland, where they developed what's called the anthropocentrism scale. It's very simple. It's got a circle with all the beings in it, humans dispersed in there, and then it has the triangle with the human at the top. And there's a little slider, and they just ask people, they say, in terms of humans' dominion and control over the natural world, where do you fall? Where do you think we should be? And people move this dial along the scale from the circle, where it's very ecocentric, to the triangle with the human at the top that's very anthropocentric. And it's like 1 through 7, and they just put themselves on the scale. And what they did is they did the study in 11 countries with 3,000 people. And then they gave them the modern racism scale, the modern social dominance hierarchy scale. They gave them the modern sexism scale. They gave them there's a bunch of scales that sort of measure. There's called a right-wing totalitarianism scale. And the correlation was through the roof. People that are scoring very high on racism, sexism, right-wing authoritarianism, social dominance scales, they also score high on anthropocentrism. So that question is then, you got to say, what was the first othering of the human? Was it othering within the human? No, actually, it was the advent of domestication of plants and animals, and it was the othering of the more than human world that then birthed the systems of oppression that include slavery and warfare and sexism and patriarchy. So I believe, and I think the argument can be made, that if we really teach kids to see two different wren tits, or they were canyon wrens, as different beings, that we're beginning to break away from anthropocentrism, creating ecocentric worldviews that actually will do more to dismantle racism, institutionalized oppression, than anything else. So I'm kind of feeling like I think I once said to you, John, it's the most subversive thing to do to connect people to nature, because it looks benign, but it's so radical because it disrupts the prima facie domination hierarchy that humans live in that they're blind to.
Well, that was pretty well said. I'm glad we caught that on recording, Paul. That was amazing. Thank you. Well, Jenny, any last thoughts on our way out here?
I'm just grateful to be in spaces with beautiful listeners and good questions, and this chance to share what we're doing. And yeah, so just gratitude, I guess.
Yeah, well, thank you both so much for the conversation. So inspiring, and really, truly for the work that you're doing. And yeah, keep us posted. There's going to be a lot of people that want your template that you're working on, like a lot of people. So we are looking forward to that.
I just want to share a quick anecdote, John and Sarah and Aidan. I went to this conference very serendipitously at UCLA. It was called the first national or international conference on education and nature. I don't think it was the first, but anyway, that was what it was called. And it was sponsored by the lab school at UCLA, and Richard Liu was keynoting. And I went there, and I'm sitting at lunch talking to Richard Liu. And there's a woman sitting to my left, and she's listening very carefully to the conversation. And then she starts talking. And this is a woman who's a Mexican national who just came from Thailand because her American boyfriend had to undergo some medical treatment. So she came to California, but she spent the last 18 years teaching in four different nature schools in Scotland, in Lebanon, in Thailand. And she's also writing curriculum. And she told me that her entire approach to working with kids is to tell them a story, especially middle schoolers. And so I'm like, wait a minute, that's what I'm doing. So we got into this conversation and I realized out of nowhere, this woman appeared who has so much of the same orientation, thinking, spirit. And it's a little bit like how you and I met, John, how the Earth's intelligence is in constant emergence. And so this woman, we're just getting her a J-1 visa, which is called a research scholar visa for 5 years. Okay, check this out. She comes from Yucatan Peninsula. Her father's indigenous, and she had all these indigenous women raising her. And so she wanted to know, how do you tend seven generations down the line? How do you actually do that? So she went and got a master's degree from the University of Edinburgh in genetics. She has a bachelor's degree in chemistry. So she started teaching in the university and she goes, this is too late. So she went and started teaching high school. Now this is too late. And then she started teaching middle school. And the last job she had was 7-year-olds to 10-year-olds. But her idea is that it's through stories. So she's got this orientation as a researcher and scholar. So we're bringing her in to actually study what we're doing and write it up so that, and also help with all the other crazy things that we do. So this is another being that has just kind of come into our world who I know is part of the emergence of this into a larger context, into a more, let's say, global container.
Let's add energy to that. That is much needed, much needed. Yeah. Well, thank you both.
Thank you guys. Awesome. Yeah. Nice to meet you, Aiden.
Hey, it's a pleasure to meet you. And it's really an honor to get to spend time with you all and to lift this up. This is just really inspiring to hear. And I'm so grateful for the work you do.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. You can find everything related to the podcast and our current offerings at trackingconnections.net. We'll see you next time.